Fellas, she's not dressed properly. He's gonna have to leave.
Properly?
Jimmy.
What's wrong with the way we're dressed?
Stop.
These gentlemen ain't dressed right. I asked them to leave.
Is there a problem then?
The problem is your man here says we're not properly dressed. Like our money ain't green. We just want a couple of beers.
A few beers, that's it.
That's it. We'll be on our way. We ain't looking for trouble.
Spoke like a gentleman. Give me the beers. Go ahead. I appreciate
it. No problem. All right.
You got some brews down here. Nice cold ones. Got them up. Some nice cold brews. Come on. Two over here, huh?
Got them up.
One more.
All right, brothers, if I may, a toast to our host.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Look at all these kids over there.
Hey! Oh, you again, huh?
That wasn't very nice. Now he's got to leave.
I'll tell you when the fuck we leave, all right? Get the fuck away from me.
Go watch the bites, man. Yes?
Now you just can't leave.
I will never forget the look on their faces. All eight of them, their faces dropped. All their courage and strength was drained right from their bodies. They had a reputation for breaking up bars, but they knew that instant they made a fatal mistake. This time they walked into the wrong bar.
Come on, motherfucker! Come on, you scrappy motherfucker! Come on, let's go!
What more do you want from me?
Oh yeah, this is your brother Professor Carl Tone Jones, and as Sonny said, you can't leave. We're here tonight, giving you office hours on another beautiful Friday here in Philadelphia, Philly Fridays, and we're doing it right here on Fet Life Station at FetLifeStation.com. And man, it be what it be. You know what I'm saying? The weather is beautiful. It's in the mid-50s today. And as always, see, we're coming to you at the top of the hour. And this is just, you know, this is just a wonderful, you know, it's been a beautiful week. We had a few days of rain, but you know, that's all part of the cleansing that needs to take place. So, you know, it be what it bees, family. Be what it bees. I'm just happy to be here. As Eddie Murphy once said in Coming to America. So, you know, it's there's been, you know, there's some wild stuff that goes on in the world, man. And I've been having conversations with people, my close people, family and friends. And it just reminds you, you know, how good you are, how blessed you are. You know, we've been dealing with a lot of violence here in Philly, particularly with the young people. And it's been going on since 2020. But you know, what's been happening lately is the shootouts that are taking place at the as the children and the young teens exit school. So during school dismissal, we've had at least three situations this week where, you know, people have been shot in the bus depots and the bus stops where the children get on to go home. And I'm talking about public transportation. I'm not even talking about school buses. We have people who have been shot who are, you know, elderly people in their 70s, young people. And, you know, I was talking to my cousin yesterday, and it's just ironic that he was on one of the buses that got shot up. So, you know, he was grateful that he wasn't physically injured, but, you know, he had to deal with some stuff that some mental anguish, you know, because that was traumatic for him, a traumatic experience. You know, I mean, he told me that he had got down on the floor and he was encouraging other people on the bus to get on the floor because they didn't know how to handle the situation. But when he got back up, the seat that he was sitting in, there was a bullet hole. So had he not gotten to the floor, there's a possibility that he could have been one of the people that were, you know, shot. So I believe it's anywhere between 8 and 11 people. So, you know, we gotta, you know, it comes back to something that I said, and I've been working with this for years. And I have been trying to encourage, you know, other members of the community to get on board. When I used to do work, I used to do a lot of work with the young people. And I say young people, anyway, from the ages of 6, 7 to about 13. And we used to have a program where I would have Saturday morning classes on my porch. And shout out to my good brother, Joseph Ward, for his On the Shoulders of Giants series that was out back then, where he would put snippets together, educating the people, because I'm not going to just say the youth, but educating the people on, you know, key historic black figures and events and movements in history, and as well as my good sister Kara Poole with her series The Great Griot, which pretty much did the same thing. So I would utilize those programs. Shout out to Dr. DeShonda Williams, at the time, good friend of mine, who would provide me with food and meals that I would give to the young people. And they, you know, on the porch, they would take in class while, you know, eating breakfast outside. I was smart enough. In the day of and how litigation goes, I was not allowing anybody in my house. So, but we had a program where these same children would also get paid to help clean up the community. So they would each get a grocery bag and some gloves, courtesy of me. And they would clean up the blocks and clean up around the neighborhood. And, you know, there was a small stipend in it for them, but they took some pride in it. And when people were asking them what they were out there doing, they're like, I'm going to work. And you can see the pride that they took, not only working, but knowing that they were working for a black man, myself. And I would often speak to my other brothers and sisters. And I would say, we need to invest in these young children. And I can even recall having conversations with my neighbors. And they would look at me like, come on, man, you know, and it's sort of like a sheepish way of, you know, really not my problem, you know. And they would look at these children as pests. And I would tell them, listen, if you don't invest in them today, there will come a time where they won't be asking you, can they work for you? Can they pump your gas? Can they take your groceries? Can they help you with your groceries to your car? They won't be doing those things. I say, you give these children that same cold heart day in, day out. You keep feeding them that coldness. I said, eventually, the next time you see them, 4 or 5 years down the line, they're not going to be asking. They're going to take it from you. And, you know, I used to almost get into fights with people in the parking lots at the grocery store. Because I would have to, when I would see, I'm going to tell you, there was a situation where this young brother walked up to this couple, this woman and her man, and he asked them, you know, can I help you, you know, with your groceries? And I'm talking about, this young brother was so polite, so respectful, so humble. And her response to him was so nasty and cold that I saw a shift in his heart at that moment. And I had to go over there and grab that young brother. And I had to pull him to the side and say, young brother, let me explain something to you. We're not all like that. That, you know, We are, there's some of us out here who actually care about you. And I told him, I said, today at this moment, I don't have anything on me. I don't have any change. I don't have anything. I said, I promise you, the very next time I see you, I'm going to take care of you. And it just so happened that I had money the next day, like loose cash. And I gave that brother $20 for helping me with my bags to the car. And see, some may say, oh, that's steep. You got to understand something. It was a small price to pay for the salvation of that young brother's heart. That young brother, every time I saw him after that, it was a lot, for about a good year or so. He would tell me about his progress in school. He would, we got to know each other on the first name basis. If I didn't see him, he would run up to me and make sure that he acknowledged me. But his whole attitude and demeanor changed about it because somebody showed that young brother love. And Tupac talked about that. You know, you might not like me hanging with the thugs, but they showed a young brother love. So you got to understand where that comes from. And I would always, when I see the young brothers in there in the supermarkets, and people would complain so much that they eventually stopped the young brothers from out there. But there was this kid named Sincere. Sincere was probably about, when I first started seeing Sincere, he was about 8 or 9 years old. But he was at the supermarket, and he would help me with my stuff to the car. And Sincere had a little business out there, and I was glad they actually let him set up a little table. He was selling calendars. And the last time I seen Sincere was about a year ago. So I hope and pray that young brother's okay. But I would ask some questions like, you know, why are you out here? And every single time I asked him that question, he was like, because I'm hungry and I want to eat. Now, you think about what that $20 I was doing. We blow through money all the time. I don't even know where half the money goes sometimes in regards to, like, pocket change. I know I keep a certain amount, not a lot, but I also know that I hang on to it, boom, boom, boom. It may go to something frivolous, something I don't need. But that child needed to eat that day. And I don't, not only did that with the children now. Keep in mind, the local neighborhood, you know, people who were struggling, you know, with their addictions, I would also do that with them. And I need y'all to understand that, you know. And people will say, I don't understand why you're doing that. You're giving these drug dealers money because all they're going to do is take the money and get high with it. I say, I understand that. But what you don't understand is, if I didn't give them money to do a small job for me, where else would they do? What else would they do to go get that money? Chances are they'd be waiting for you to walk into your house and knock you upside your head. But, you know, I understood that as a community, we don't have a lot of foresight. So I'm speaking of that in a roundabout way because I want us to understand something. I want us to understand how if we don't pay that deposit to the youth right now, that we will deal with the steep and the steady consequence in dealing with that situation. And there's an old African proverb that we all love to tell, and it says, it takes a village to raise a child. That's a one-parter. There's two parts to that proverb, and we don't always talk about the second part. And the second part of that proverb is, if the children do not feel the love of the community, of the village, then the children will then live to burn down the village to feel its heat. And we need to understand what that means and where that comes from in regards to how we're going about dealing with our young people and how we get to today. Because these children didn't wake up wanting to be thugs. They didn't wake up wanting to be killers. But this is where they get there. And then we turn a blind eye on them. And I used to go into high schools. And one of the things that happened when I would go into high schools is I would often talk to the students, but I would start off with an apology. And my apology was because, you know, I would say, you know, I'm here to apologize first and foremost because my generation did not prepare the world for you. And then we did not prepare you for the world that you live in. We did not terraform the world, and we did not prepare you for the world, the hardships that we're dealing with in this world today. And that's something that always plays with me. And it's funny, right? Because I was coming home last night from the store, and I happened to get to the corner, and I saw some guys on the corner I didn't recognize, which is rare in my neighborhood. So while I'm getting out the car, it was this tall brother about 6'4" standing right next to the, you know, to the, and he's standing right next to the back of my car, and he caught me off guard. And lo and behold, this is one of the young people that I worked with, you know, going back over a decade, going back to, you know, the early parts of 2010, 2011. This is one of the kids on my block. And he always stops, but it was dark and I didn't see him. And I'm thinking about the cats I just saw in the corner. I said, oh shit, is this a setup? But, you know, he just stopped and he started smiling when he saw me. And, you know, I love this kid. He always pulls up and lets me know his progress. He's in automotive mechanic school right now, and he's training to do certain things. And I just love the fact that every single one of those kids that I bump into is doing something different with their lives. And at the very least, they're very respectful. They did not turn to the situations that their peers turned to in the streets. And I like to think that I had something to do with that, because I spent some time with these young people. And I think that we need to start developing those types of relationships with our young people again. For some of these young cats, they're probably too far gone. Like, if you can pull up at a stop and not care, at a bus stop and not care who you hit, then that speaks to a level of, that speaks to a level of sociopathic behavior, you know, that people develop when you don't care about the people who are harmed, the people who are injured, you know, in light of you gunning somebody down. And a lot of parents have turned a blind eye, because a lot of these kids go home. A lot of these parents have not checked their children's rooms. Because a lot of stuff is done by teenagers. These cats don't live on their own. They're not checking their children's rooms. They're not, you know, having conversations with their children about what they're doing out here in these streets. And it's just like, we just don't want to be accountable for a lot of things. Now, I am first and foremost always going to point to the circumstances that have led to the downfall of our community. I'm always going to point it, you know, to, because what you're seeing happen is a symptom. These are all symptoms of greater circumstances, you know, because you don't just see this here in America in black neighborhoods. You see this globally in black communities. And so you have to ask yourself, well, who is the dominating power in these communities? I got news for you. It ain't the black folk, the faces that are in front of you that you see on the newspaper, on the daily news, or, you know, the ones that are creeping up and jumping out in front of the cameras. It ain't them. Unfortunately, you know, we have a lot of puppets, but we have to be concerned about the puppet masters that are distributing the harm to our communities, that are distributing, that are putting us in these predicaments. I'm not saying we don't have a purpose or a cause to be accountable, because at the end of the day, the buck stops with us. And that means we have to stop selling out. And when I speak to selling out, I'm really speaking to the nature of how we move and operate within the community. right? Because if we want to speak to the village, raising our children, being a part, we can't just turn to the village when things are going wrong. We can't just turn to the village when things are out of control and we can't control them. We need to turn to the village early on and become a village again. But then that means putting down certain things we're cool and comfortable with. Because let's face it, if we're out there promoting hood culture and we like hood culture because we feel as though hood culture doesn't hold us to a high standard, let's just be clear about that. Hood culture doesn't hold us to the standard of being standard bearers in our community, then nothing's going to change. You know, the first teacher of our children are the parents, specifically the mothers. And if the mothers are not going to be the ones being held accountable, and listen, we operate from a place of do not what I say, but do what I say, but not what I do. These children are watching us. This is why I have great relationships with the young people in my community that other people are terrorized of. I walk around the corner, these young cats will call me Unc. Half of them don't know my name, but they respect the way I carry myself and they respect the work that I've done in this community my entire life. The cats that are around here, the ones that run the block, this, that, and the other, you know, I'm just saying, you know, we're very cordial. And I don't say that from a perspective that I endorse what they do. It's just an understanding about where we are. And we have to understand the nature of our communities. You know, I came on tonight and I was going to talk about something totally different. But I guess I'll say that for another show, because I think this is something that's pertinent to me. I'm a very spiritual person. And I think sometimes when the Most High speaks to you, you know, you need to go through, you need to follow through with the message that he plants on your heart. And this message to me, I mean, you know, I'm not even going to lie, man. When I first, I wouldn't say that, I mean, all people are emotional. So to say that I'm not emotional would be, you know, that'd be a lie. That'd be disingenuous. But I'm typically a person that is in control of my emotions. A few years ago, I started researching the drill rap culture. Because for the life of me, I couldn't figure out, like, in 2020, like, why did the violence escalate in times when nobody was on the street? It was just boggling to me. Mind-boggling. So I saw an interview. It was a Vlad TV interview. And I don't really care for Vlad, because he's a culture vulture, in my opinion. But it was something that flashed across my timeline. And he was interviewing a rapper out of Jacksonville. I think the young brother's name was Julio Fulio or something like that. I think it was Fulio. And, you know, he had talked about trying to ambush somebody in the hotel room and how they were using the girls from Jacksonville to, you know, to line people up, set traps. And he was talking about his beef with another rapper down there by the name of Young and Ace. And so I started, you know, I looked up the Young and Ace interview, and I'm looking at this young brother like, this is just, you know, this is a kid, you know. And he was talking about how much he was in the studio and how he was just making music and how he was trying to stay out of trouble. So then I started looking up their music. And then there was a song that came out at that time called the Beatbox Remix. So one song was the Beatbox by another kid from Miami. This little babyface gangster, I can't even remember his name. He just looked like he was 13 years old with a mouth full of metal. And But I saw the size of the guns he had on that video, and I'm like, holy crap, holy cow. I'm trying to watch my language, y'all. But I was watching the videos, and then I saw the Beatbox remix, the Fulio remix. And it was the one that came with a dance that everybody had popularized. And that's pretty much what actually led me to that video too. Is it was a popular dance that came out. And so I watched the dance and the video with the dance, and there was a part in there where a young brother was missing. His name was Corbin. And they was talking about how Corbin got, you know, kidnapped and, you know, and then Corbin got found. And then, you know, the ad lib was, where's Corbin? And I saw so many of the celebrities who were sort of like doing their dance, doing the where's Corbin. So I looked that aspect up about that video, and come to find out the young brother was part of one of the other gangs with the brother Young and Ace. He was kidnapped coming from a job interview and had disappeared. Nobody could find him for a whole year. So his mother, somebody who was mowing the lawn, found a dismembered body, the dismembered body of Corbin. And you know, his mother, you know, and I think this really broke my heart too. His mother was pleading with people to stop mocking the murder of her son. And people continued to, you know, do the where's Corbin, you know, but it was gimmicky, but it was sad to see that. And I think about the moral compass of our people and how we are so desensitized to things that are inherently evil these days. So I'm not going to lie, when I started doing, and I started, and at the time I was doing, I had a podcast on YouTube, and we called it Somebody Has to Say It. It was one of my podcasts on YouTube. I had a few, and they yanked my channel down, but it's all good. I did a series on drill rap. Spiritually, it's one of the hardest things I think I've ever had to do concerning podcasting. I'm talking about, and this is what I talk about, the emotional part. I broke down crying because I looked at how many of our young people were just dying incessantly in the streets for nothing more than beef over, you know, it wasn't even drug beef. It wasn't even turf wars. This was social media beef. This was social media beef. It was something that was so petty. And we see our children just falling. And, you know, the concept of it all, it was, like I said, it was heartbreaking. So then I took it from Jacksonville. And I remember seeing some stuff, like, I didn't know the title of it. I didn't know it was called drill rap. But I remember seeing some stuff in Philly rap. And lo and behold, you had people who were covering the drill rap scene in Philly. And the thing that was most disturbing about it was the fact that it had been going on since, you know, way before 2020. You can almost go back to some of this for 10 years. They had a sister up here. She was called the Backdoor Queen because allegedly she was the one that was known for setting rappers up to be murdered. They had a lot of these other brothers up here who, you know, they would, some of them would survive being shot, and they would do videos talking about them still alive, but they'd be in the hospital with, you know, bullet holes. Their bodies be riddled with bullet holes. Or you'd have some of them who were young, promising rappers, but they ended up dead, you know. And to see so many young people who felt as though they were so desensitized to death that if you killed one of their friends, they would talk about it, but they would, it became so routine that it was expected. These young cats didn't expect to see 20 years old, 18, 20 years old. And I can remember being that young cat. So many of my friends, because I grew up during the crack cocaine era, so I didn't expect to see the age of 18. I celebrated my 18th birthday on the campus of Bloomsburg University. I had gone there in the summer, June, for the summer session. And the next day was my birthday, my 18th birthday. But I didn't, be so many people around me were dropping. I didn't expect to see 18. And I wasn't no hood, this, that, and the other. I hung with a lot of hoods, though. Don't get it twisted. But I wasn't that. But still, the culture. But it was even different back then because, you know, back then, if you were in the game, you kind of expected. And I wasn't even in the game, but I was connected to people who were in the game. So naturally, if you see them dropping, you might not expect to see your 18th birthday. And that's the sad psychosis of being young and black and being a man in this time and era. I was actually, you know, one of the people that Hillary Clinton affectionately referred to as a super predator that needed to be brought to heel. Didn't matter whether you were committing crimes or not. You, if you were young and black, you fit in that category. So, and we get back to the whole concept around the drill rap, right? Because that's kind of what we're dealing with today. And I can recall when it first came to America, because drill rap didn't start in America. It actually started in the UK. And it was a certain type of rap where they would, you know, rap, 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 boom, 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 boom. It had a certain rhythm to it. But when drill rap came to America, excuse me, trying to clear my throat here. The post-nasal trip going on. When drill rap came to America, one of the people that really took to it was a rapper by the name of Chief Keef out of Chicago. And I can recall, you know, I mean, I was inquisitive at that time. And so I started following Chief Keef because I started listening to his songs, especially I think he had one out called This Is What I Don't Like. And it was the first time I had seen a group of young men, had to be about 25 young men under, like, in a room. And they were, you know, it didn't look wild at that time. It was just different because typically around that time, rappers always wanted to have girls in the room. There was no girls in the room. So I'm like, okay, what's this about? So later on, it came out that there was like some tweets and some YouTube videos of people who were in rival gangs at that time. And one of his ops, as they call it, was a young brother. I can't even recall his name, but they had a video of him driving through a neighborhood in Chicago and somebody yelling at him, you know, I'm going to kill you when I see you. And like 2 days later, that young brother was dead. And Chief Keef was putting out tweets, laughing and bragging about it. And talking about, you know, smoking. And that's when they started putting labels on bags of marijuana. And they would say they're smoking their, you know, the dead ops. That's where that came from. The most disturbing part about the entire story is that I think later on that week, Chief Keef was given a $5 million signing bonus by one of the big record labels. And I thought to myself at that moment, you're setting a very dangerous trend here. And I think it was done on purpose. Because you set that trend. Now all these other young rappers were going to, you know, and with turn to this. And what you started seeing is it wasn't rappers who wanted to be gangsters. It was street gangsters who took to that whole concept of, you know, being on the block and this, that, and the other, they took to music and they realized they can make money in music, rapping about the stuff they were doing on the streets. And so that's when you get the King Vines from, you know, all these other young cats out here who were rapping about the stuff they did on the streets. And, you know, I mean, Chicago, you can look at Chicago too. You can look at Memphis. You can look at, you know, L.A. L.A.'s never really took their foot off the brake. They was on that gang shit for a long time. And, you know, you start to draw it back and understand, like, wow, this thing is like a pot that's starting to bubble and boil. It's going to start boiling out of control. And now you have these instances where I started, like 2 years ago, I was actually working, a good brother of mine, my brother Oba Sankofa, had hired me because he runs a program called the University of Rap here in Philly, and they work in conjunction with the schools, and they sort of like mix music and education together. So he had hired me as a history teacher, and he hired another young brother, Eli Capella. All right, and we were supposed to co-teach at this middle school, Universal Charter. There's a middle school out in South Philly, right? And so we started having, like, I overheard, like, you know, you hear the young people talk, especially the eighth graders. And the eighth grade, we talking about the young boys and their violence, and they start pointing to the girls. They was like, well, they're the ones that cause all the trouble. And I was like, what do you mean? They said, they're the ones that set traps for dudes. And, you know, the girls in the back, like, that's, you know, like, kind of joking it off and laughing it off. But you can see the correlation here. So then, you know, we were talking about it and talking about the gangs, and the young brothers was like, you know, there's certain places we can't go. And I'm shocked by this because, you know, Philly is territorial, but Philly was never really a gangland city, not since the 70s. Right? You know, Philly used to be gangland, but in the 70s, when it was building in other cities, you know, the elders who ran the House of Emoji out in West Philly called together a citywide gang truce. And that pretty much put an end to that in the 70s. So that neighborhood cliques, but you didn't have gangs. But now they were talking about there were certain places they couldn't go. And what are you talking about? They said, and they used to call me Brother Jones. You know, and he said, Brother Jones, look at this. And one of them went up to the smart board and pulled up and went to Google and pulled up this page that was called Philly Gang Maps. Now, I did not know anything about this, but it had a Philly gang map where it showed that certain neighborhoods, and it was color coded each, you know, and you tap on each one of the blocks that were in that range or in that place. And it even had a legend for who the name of the gang or the name of the neighborhood. And it had a legend about how they became what they are. And it blew my mind. I was thankful that somebody took time out to put it together. But at the same time, it blew my mind. Now, this was Black History Month, too, while we were going over this. So one of the projects that I assigned the students was to learn about, you know, the Green Book. And for those of you who don't know who the Green Book is, the Green Book was put together by a brother out of New York. He was, I believe his name is Stanley Green. If I'm not mistaken, I might be getting his name wrong. So let me check that while I'm doing this here, man, because, you know. I want to make sure I get that right. You know, I want to make sure, because that's just not, you know, I want to, because you might look it up. And there was a movie out called The Green Book not too long ago. So Let me see. Green Book. No use to having these high price devices and we don't look it up, right? The Green Book. Da-da-da-da-da. And I gotta go through all the Netflix stuff. So, but the Green Book was designed for black people to have a safe way to navigate through the city. Victor Hugo Green. Sorry about that. So Victor Hugo Green, who happened to be a mailman in New York, he put together a book for black people, a travel guide for black people to be able to navigate safely throughout the cities and the township and the nation, to be able to navigate safely, because there were a lot of sundown towns. And this is during the Jim Crow era. So this is after slavery, you know, and currently what people like to identify as the civil rights era. This is around that time. So he would put together a travel guide that allowed people to travel routes, safe hotels, a safe lodging, places that people wanted to go get a haircut, if women wanted to get their hair done, for grooming, places that people can go and party. So it talked about lounges and bars that were available in these particular cities. And it also told people how much money they need for tolls on these particular roads. I mean, the book was dynamic, and every city had a book. Every city or state had a book. So, and if you watch the first episode of Lovecraft Country, excuse me, if you watch the first episode of Lovecraft Country, you will be able to see somewhat how they were able to generate a map for the Green Book. And a lot of brothers and sisters, you know, face some very dangerous times. They did that, but they did that because they understood the need for black people to be able to travel safely and navigate safely throughout the country. So I gave the students a Green Book assignment. See, hold on 1 second, I gotta drink some water. I've been fighting this. thank you. I've been fighting this post nasal drip the whole time. And my apologies to anybody that heard that. So my assignment for these young people were that they had to create and generate their own Green Book. Their own map, using the Philly gang map to navigate safe travel to home. And in addition to just safe travel, they had to they could not use public transportation. They could not use the main street, so they couldn't use Broad Street, and they couldn't use Columbus Avenue. And since we're in South Philly, most of the students live in South Philly, so they pretty much had to navigate around a couple gangs. But they also had to find a place that, you know, they could find something to eat and, you know, report back. And let me tell you how brilliant these young people are. They navigated a way to each other's houses as safe houses along the route to getting home. They understood there were certain stores that they can buy food and snacks from. It was beautiful to see that. And that's what I mean when I say, man, we need to start investing more in our young people, man. And I saw one of the children from the program. She ran up to me and gave me a big hug because she didn't expect to see me when I was when I started working at Community College of Philadelphia. She saw me on the street, and I didn't even recognize her at first, but she ran up and gave me a big hug. And you know, she was one of the more enthusiastic students, and she is sharp as a whip. Let me tell you something, a very bright young lady, and I'm expecting big things out of her. But that's what I mean, though. When you show these young people love, our young people love, they reciprocated because the world hates them. You know that because the world hates you. So you are going to precipitate that and reciprocate that hatred towards our own children? Just think about this, because I've had this conversation with brothers, and you know, social media, if you use it properly, can be an effective communication tool. And I would have this conversation with brothers, and I would say, brother, you know, why are you what's your role here, you know, in terms of dealing with the youth and the young people? And the first response I got is, well, I take care of my own. I can't worry about nobody else's child. I said, you know, the irony is, most of your children, if they come into it, they're going to come into it with one of the ones you decided not to take care of, and then they're going to take care of your child. What are you going to do then? What are you going to do then? Most of our young people are spiraling out of control. Most of our young people are on kamikaze missions. A lot of times they don't even care. And I'm saying most, because yes, your good child too can be affected by what's going on in these streets. And they're on kamikaze missions. Yes, they're on these missions. They're on a kamikaze mission. And that's what's happening with a lot of our children, a lot of our babies out here in these streets. And they're going to take other people down with them. Remember what we said. If they don't feel the warmth from the village, they don't feel the love from the village, or the warmth, the love, they will burn the village down just to feel the heat. And that's what we're seeing right now. Now, we used to have a program here, and I was talking to a brother of mine yesterday who was one of the heads of that program, one of the leads of that program, Brother Nkrumah, BF Nkrumah. And we had a program called the Black Captains. And the goal of the program was to have at least one solid brother on every block where black people lived that was in charge of the supervision, custodial matters of that block, you know, the cleanliness of that block, and sort of like seen as the leader in that community on that block. And if we had one on every block, then we would be able to have a group of men who was able to hold the community down. Now, we tried to do that, but brothers thought it was more important to watch the Eagles on Sunday. So they thought it was more important to watch the football game on Sunday. And I ain't mad at you, but, you know, you got children out here. And you got children in these streets. Is it really going to matter, the final score of that football game, if you're sitting there and the medical examiner gives you a phone call asking you to come to, you know, to the hospital? Because when a medical examiner calls you, it's not about a rescue operation at that point. The medical examiner is addressing you from the perspective of your child no longer being here. You need to come identify the body. How important is the final score of that Eagles game then? How important is it, you know, about where they are in the standings then? And so, you know, we put a call to the brothers, man, because you can't hope that somebody else is going to do this for you. I understand we operate from a place of being demoralized, but from a place of feeling castrated as men. But your same castrated brothers made children in this world. And even if you didn't make children in this world, you have an obligation to be an upstanding role model for these young men. somebody who they can come to and help walk them through a tough and difficult situation. Somebody who you could teach about the rigors of peer pressure and how at that moment, stepping away from a situation doesn't make them a punk. It doesn't make them a coward. In fact, it takes a lot of courage to address peer pressure and say, no, I'm not going on this ride. It takes a lot of courage to say, I'd rather be alone if this is what my homies require. It takes a lot of courage to say, hey, young lady, young sister, you can't get me or convince me to go on a kamikaze mission just because your feelings are hurt. And it's definitely not a death sentence that somebody hurts your feelings. We have to get to that place to where we start to identify, you know, the things in our community that matter, because we can't consistently, you know, I see, you know, people doing things and it's safe. I get it. I respect it, but it's real safe. But the real thing is, you know, parents, and if you're a single parent, this is doubly for you, because you don't get to have the excuse of saying that, you know, I did all I can by myself. There were choices made to bring these children in this world. You have a responsibility now. And there's no excuses for falling short on those responsibilities. And this is why we have to pass messages on to the future, to make sure you choose and vet wisely of who you plan on procreating with. And then if you're not intending on a long-term relationship, aka marriage, then maybe you should think twice about engaging in the practices that could possibly lead to procreation. This is discipline. This is responsibility. This is our time. We don't have time to babyfoot this. We don't have time. This is an integral part in our history, and we're watching our cities burn. New York City just established that they're going to have the National Guard monitoring their public transportation hubs. They got people literally going, it's like a Gestapo, with people having to open up their bags, their purses and whatever, just to get on the train. You know, it's all fun and games until it happens. And unfortunately, unfortunately, we can't seem to convince these young people from the outside that they're not going to like where this is going. Need to study the Watts riots in the 60s. Need to study the Watts riots and see where that went. You know, if you want to talk about urban settings and this whole concept around the way, you know, we start dealing with each other, we have to start teaching our young people how to love and respect life. But that means we have to love and respect life, right? Because they operate from our example. Our example is their sample. And if we're not operating from a place where we can actually show them the right way to go, the right way to live, the right way to be, then can we really blame them? Of course, they absorb some of the blame, because at the end of the day, everybody should know right from wrong. But we create a lot of gray areas where we don't instill that as the culture. We create a lot of gray areas when we ourselves don't want to operate in what's black and white. So that's something that needs to be highly considered in regards to how we move and operate from this day forward. You know, our babies are crying. They're crying for us. They're crying for our help. Are we going to continue to turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to their screams? This is what you see happening in the streets. This is what you see going on. The question is now, what say you? What are you going to do to improve the circumstances and situations for our babies? One of the reasons why I stepped away from the movement, the so-called Black Liberation Movement and so forth, is because I didn't see enough work going into procuring a life for these children. I saw a bunch of old folks who were only concerned about their causes, their cares, their issues. We would operate right in the same neighborhoods and communities, but it was very little outreach, especially to the young people. You can see schools from where we were operating from. You can see the township from where we were operating from. We talk about going down south and all those other places that we were at. And when I offered to go walk around these places, this, that, and the other, it was met with, I won't say disdain, but it definitely wasn't enthusiasm. So that's why I really enjoy the work I do. I get to sit there and talk and have an influence on a number of young people. Help them through some of the tough times they're dealing with in life. Walk them through the malaise that they're dealing with and struggling with. Let them understand and identify that they're not alone. That they have somebody in their corner. Because many of these young people feel like they don't have anybody. So they turn to violence, or they explode, or they implode. And sometimes the violence is internal. You don't see it, but these young cats are out here self-medicating, which then inebriates them and puts them in places where they will make bad decisions. And we try to just walk past and pretend. I see it every day. I see people ignore it every day. I see people walk by it every day. And it unfortunately overshadows the people who are actually trying to be remedies to what's happening in the community. Shout out to my good brother Arnett Woodall at West Philly Produce for all the work he's been doing for years. Turned a drug lot into a productive Black business that sells healthy food and works with youth from various high schools throughout the city, teaching them entrepreneurship, responsibility, respect, but also pride in who they are. Ashe, I salute you, beloved. And with that said, man, I'm tucking out of here. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to Office Hours with your dear brother, Professor Carl Tone Jones. Like I say, man, war and peace, baby. Because if you want peace, you better be willing to wage war for it. Ashe. Thank you.